We appreciate council setting up. We have only one argument this morning. Have all of you read our written procedures? Does any of you have any questions?
No, Your Honor.
With respect to the defendants who are separately represented, you only have 15 minutes total. So how you divide that time and how you monitor not going over somebody else's time is entirely up to you. All right.
May it please the court, my name is James Schmale. My bar number is 026246. Kathleen McEwen is at the table for appellant. Her bar number is 026843. We are here today to discuss matters of law that arise out of the dismissal of appellate Hegwood's claims against appellees Smith, Bunnell, and Kane. The court must look further back to a 2004 civil case where Mr. Hegwood, doing business as Affordable Country Homes, sued appellees Smith and Bunnell for fraud in a real estate transaction. While the jury waited, the parties conducted settlement negotiations and agreed to settle the case for $375,000. Part of the consideration to be paid was the conveyance of three residential lots which were ready to build that Mr. Kane represented as being unencumbered and ready to build. Shortly after the matter was dismissed with prejudice, Mr. Hegwood discovered that Mr. Kane made several material misrepresentations during the settlement negotiations. Further investigation revealed numerous other material facts that had not been disclosed in the settlement negotiations. The trial court denied Mr. Hegwood's Rule 60 motion and Hegwood appeal. The Court of Appeals requested supplemental briefs on whether the trial court had jurisdiction to reform the settlement agreement, and as a matter of first impression, held that claims for affirmative relief beyond the reopening of a judgment cannot be adjudicated under Rule 60 motion, but must be asserted in a new and independent suit. Mr. Hegwood filed a new and independent action against Mr. Smith and Mr. Bunnell, and also named Mr. Kane as defendant because he made the misrepresentations and concealed the material facts in the settlement negotiations. The trial court dismissed the new action against Smith and Bunnell exclusively on the grounds of res judicata and claim preclusion, relying upon the September 12, 2006 order in the 2004 case and citing dicta in the Court of Appeals decision in Affordable Country Homes. The trial court also granted Mr. Kane's Rule 12B5 motion and dismissed the claims against Mr. Kane on the grounds that Hegwood failed to plead fraud with particularity and on factual findings that the court relied on in the underlying order in the underlying case.
Mr. Schmale, could I ask you, I just want to make sure I'm not missing something. You just said the court dismissed both motions. The court granted summary judgment regarding Smith and Bunnell, but dismissed regarding Kane, right?
I misspoke, Your Honor. Okay. I'm a little nervous.
That's fine. Just want to make sure I wasn't missing it.
The court dismissed the claims against all parties in the case.
All right, but it was summary judgment on Smith and Bunnell. The court treated the motion to dismiss as a summary judgment motion.
That's correct, Your
Honor. The court did not do the same with respect to Mr. Kane.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
The standard of review for these matters is de novo. The order upon which the trial court dismissed the claims against Bunnell and Smith was found by this court to have been issued absent jurisdiction. The Colorado Court of Appeals in Affordable Country Homes stated that the authority to grant relief pursuant to Rule 60 is limited to setting aside the judgment of dismissal. Thus, the order upon which the trial court relied in applying the doctrines of res judicata and claim preclusion is void for want of jurisdiction. The doctrines of claim preclusion and res judicata require the presence of a finality of the judgment where the issues were actually decided on the merits. A final judgment on the merits is one which actually passes directly on the substance of a particular matter before the court and does not address mere matters of practice, procedure, jurisdiction, or form. The doctrine of res judicata requires that the former judgment have concerned a matter within the jurisdiction of the court. In Affordable Country Homes, the Court of Appeals noted that although neither party questioned the jurisdiction of the district court or the jurisdiction of the appellate court, to hear this appeal. Jurisdiction is an issue that we may resolve sui sponte, raise and resolve sui sponte. And it stated that Affordable Country Homes Rule 60 motion did not invoke the court's limited authority to grant relief beyond setting aside the judgment of dismissal. It further stated that the assumption of authority to proceed in a cause does not confer jurisdiction where jurisdiction does not exist.
Mr. Schmel, can I interrupt you? I'm sorry to get you going. I don't know that this makes that much of a difference, and it may be nitpicky, but I'm not sure, and I'd like you to address this issue. You keep talking about jurisdiction. There's no question the court had jurisdiction to rule on the Rule 60 motion. It could have just said, I don't have authority to grant. This is the relief isn't not available under Rule 60, therefore denied. Again, there may not be a distinction, but I'm not so sure. It's a jurisdictional question. The Court of Appeals, the division said there was no authority to rule under Rule 60, but it was not, I don't think, an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. I'd appreciate your addressing that.
The district court in the lower case did have authority to hear the motion and to deny it because it didn't have jurisdiction to hear the relief requested. Authority and jurisdiction are very synonymous in the law, as addressed in our brief.
Okay, thank you.
The court further held that a court may not, the appellate court further held that a court may not use Rule 60 to grant affirmative relief in addition to the relief contained in the prior order of judgment, and it must be asserted in a new action. This is important because essentially what the new trial court has done in the most recent case is to grant affirmative relief based on the order in the underlying case. A void judgment is a judgment where the jurisdictional issue, jurisdictional defects exist, and as a nullity, the order in the underlying case, the order of September 12, 2006, cannot be used to grant affirmative relief. And the trial court's order of June 11, 2009, dismissing Hegwood's claims against Smith and Bunnell on the grounds of res judicata and claim preclusion is clear error. The court granted Mr. Kane's motion to dismiss under 12b-5, and that should be reviewed de novo as well. Only where a complaint fails to give defendants notice of the claims asserted is dismissal under subsection b-5 appropriate. Hegwood incorporated the factual statements in the complaint pursuant to Rule 10C in his claims against Mr. Kane. Essentially, 10C mirrors the federal Rule 10C, which applies to claims for fraud as well as to all other claims. Appellees never mentioned 10C in their briefs and presumably do not contest Mr. Hegwood's right to incorporate by reference in the complaint. 10C was intended to eliminate unnecessary repetition in complaints and other pleadings. In Borgwick, the Colorado Court of Appeals considered a 38-page complaint with 178 paragraphs and 36 claims. The court held that even though the complaint is not simple, concise, and direct, it was error to dismiss the complaint. Hegwood's second amended complaint is 7 pages long. It contains 60 clear and concise paragraphs. The first paragraph of each claim incorporates the factual allegations in the complaint. Rule 9B only requires that the pleadings give notice to the defendants of the fraudulent statements for which they're alleged to be responsible. The sufficiency of a complaint must be judged by the complaint in its entirety, rather than in a piecemeal fashion. It is sufficient to state the main facts constituting the fraud. Plaintiff's second amended complaint at paragraphs 9 and 24 alleges that defendant Kane made the misrepresentations in the settlement negotiations conducted during trial. Paragraphs 12, 13, and 15 specify the misrepresentations with particularity. Paragraphs 17, 18, 19, and 20 allege facts showing the representations made by Mr. Kane are false. The trial court also found that plaintiff failed to specifically state what defendant Kane concealed. Paragraph 17 of the second amended complaint states, the material facts concealed from plaintiff include but are not listed to the following, after which plaintiff lists 5 separate and specific material facts concealed from plaintiff during the settlement negotiations. Paragraph 18 states with specificity an additional 9 material facts that Mr. Kane did not disclose in the settlement negotiations. The complaint clearly states a claim for fraud against Mr. Kane. It states when and where these negotiations occurred, specifies with specificity the misrepresentations and material facts that were concealed. Nevertheless, if the language employed to state the claim is not sufficiently descriptive, the remedy is not dismissal. It is to require a motion for a more definitive statement or a bill of particulars. Appellee Kane also argues that Hegwood did not allege that Kane knew the misrepresentations he made were false and that he was protected as he was acting on his client's behalf. In Patridge v. Yeoman, the Colorado Supreme Court stated, he who makes a representation of his own knowledge, not knowing whether it be true or false, and it is in fact untrue, is guilty of fraud as much as if he knew it to be untrue. In Meredith v. Ramsdell, the court stated that a defrauded party may proceed against the principal or the agent who procured the execution of the contract.
Let me, it concerns Mr. Kane, let me distinguish between fraud and concealment. Do you have any authority that an attorney negotiating a settlement in a clearly adversarial relationship has an affirmative duty to disclose information that could well be to his client's disadvantage?
Your Honor, I believe that the restatement of second torts covers that matter with regard to the negotiation of any contract. It's appellant's position that Mr. Kane, regardless of whether he's an attorney or a carpet layer, if he's negotiating as the agent for someone else for a contract, then he has the obligation to disclose things that a reasonable person would want to know regarding the consideration in the contract.
What about his obligation to preserve the confidentiality of information that he knows solely by virtue of communications with his client?
Your Honor, I believe that obligation of confidentiality does not extend to the ability to for his clients or for himself to commit fraud based on that confidentiality provision. His clients, the principals, had an obligation to disclose the information in the contract negotiations, which settlement agreements are contracts. And they're not excused from that simply because they're in the middle of a trial. Had they done this early on before the trial had existed and negotiated a contract for settlement without disclosing what was required to be disclosed in any contract, they would be guilty of the same thing. The fact that Mr. Kane's an attorney doesn't change his obligation as an agent negotiating a contract. And I don't believe that any information that is material to the consideration that's offered in the agreement can be concealed on the basis that it is attorney-client privilege.
Mr. Schmell, while you've stopped, let me ask you, or I'll tell you what my principal concern is with your argument here, and I'd like you to respond to it. You have a settlement agreement in here that says on its face, I did any investigation I wanted to do. I'm paraphrasing, of course. I did all the review. I've had a chance to talk to my lawyer. I did it all. I didn't rely on anything else. Why couldn't we affirm summary judgment on that basis? That goes to life. Forget the fact that this information was public. Your client signed a document that said I did everything I needed to do. And so why could we not affirm summary judgment on that basis?
Your Honor, I don't have the cases in front of me, but we cited them in our briefs. The Colorado Supreme Court has repeatedly held that that provision in a contract cannot be used to commit fraud. If that provision could be used, then it would be in every contract and there would be no such thing as fraud in the inducement. Under existing Colorado law, as Smith and Bunnell's agent, Kane is liable for the material misrepresentations in the settlement negotiations and the concealment. His remedy under Colorado law lies in indemnity if he was not a party to the fraud. This court, however, should take very seriously two significant and undisputed facts in this case. Mr. Kane has never denied that he made the misrepresentations alleged in the complaint, and he admitted that he was not privy to the information that was concealed in the complaint. And with that, Your Honors, I'll just say that there is no evidence in the record whatsoever to support the factual finding of the lower court that we had 10 days to investigate this. There is evidence in the record that shows that we were deterred from investigation, that we repeatedly requested the lots be identified so that we could conduct an investigation, and we were not given that information until late on the Friday before the settlement agreement was required to be filed with the district court on Monday. Thank you.
I may please the court. I'm Troy Rackham, and along with my partner, Cindy Fleischner, who's back here, where there wasn't enough room at the council table, we have the privilege of representing Mr. Kane. We've agreed on the appellee's side to split our time evenly, so when I see seven, I'll do my best to sit down. As the court knows, Kevin Kane represented Smith and Bunnell in the underlying case, which settled. Plaintiff's counsel noted the terms of the settlement on the record, and then it was later reduced to writing. That writing has been specifically pled in the plaintiff's complaint and incorporated into the plaintiff's complaint if you look at paragraph 15. So the trial court properly could consider it, and this court properly could consider it as part of the pleadings under a Rule 12b-5 standard as opposed to summary judgment. But rather than exercise the plaintiff's rights under the settlement agreement, plaintiff sued as opposing counsel for fraud. He didn't bring a breach of contract claim against the parties to the settlement agreement. He sued his opposing counsel for fraud. The chutzpah does not begin to describe plaintiff's approach to this case. The trial court dismissed plaintiff's claims, and this court should affirm the trial court's dismissal for three reasons. First, the plaintiff failed to state a claim either for fraud by misrepresentation or fraud by concealment. Second, the plaintiff's second amended complaint, which was their third complaint, did not comply with the pleading standards required under Rule 9b. And third, the plaintiff failed to file a certificate of review. Indeed, even to this day, has not filed a certificate of review, which provides an independent basis for this court to affirm.
Why is the certificate?
The plaintiff's claims assert that Mr. Kane should have known a variety of facts and should have disclosed those variety of facts. In Williams versus Boyle, this court, I think Chief Judge Davidson specifically held that claims that a professional should have done certain things or should have disclosed certain things to their, in that case it was a patient, requires a certificate of review. So,
but I mean, doesn't that assume that there's an attorney-client relationship or a doctor-patient relationship at issue? I mean, here he's a third party to that relationship.
It does. If the court looks at Tyken versus Reynolds, there was an absence of that kind of privity relationship. If the court looks at, I think, Crystal Holmes versus Baumgarten versus Coppedge, the issue there was whether there was that privity relationship. So respectfully, I would disagree that the 1320.602 specifically requires a claim against a licensed professional that requires expert testimony. It doesn't say there has to be the certificate of review motion was briefed below. It was fully briefed. The trial court didn't rule on it because it didn't need to. It had already dismissed the claims for failure to state a claim.
Did you raise it here? Is it in your answer brief?
We noted it in our answer brief. We didn't argue it because it wasn't responsive to appellant's arguments. But going back to the first reason, which is the principal reason this court should affirm the trial court, and that is the trial court's dismissal for failure to state a claim was proper. There are a number of reasons why the plaintiff's claims failed to state a claim. First, there were no allegations of fact that Mr. Kane knew that the representations he was making in the settlement negotiation were false. Second, the alleged statements were not misrepresentations of fact. Under this court's analysis in the Bedard versus Martin case, which is 105 P3rd 584, in that case, Judge Russell specifically looked at very similar allegations of fact and noted that those allegations of fact were not misrepresentations.
I'm sorry, I know you have very limited time, Mr. Rackham. You said Kane, there's no allegation Kane knew. They specifically allege Kane, quote, knew or should have known of the concealment of the above material facts and had a duty to disclose the material facts. And I'm trying to find it. I got the Second Amendment complaint here. There is an allegation, I think, directly that said he knew or acted knowing he didn't know the truth.
And those are kind of Janus-based allegations because they say that in the complaint, and then they attach to their complaint an affidavit where plaintiff's counsel specifically says, we don't have any basis to believe that Mr. Kane knew.
But the court ruled only, we have to rely only on the face of the complaint because the
and
court.
And what is incorporated into the complaint.
Okay, but you have a factual allegation of the complaint. You're arguing basically a factual dispute.
Right, but when a complaint itself creates a factual dispute, I submit that that shouldn't be sufficient grounds to allow or to avoid a dismissal for failure to state a claim.
And I'm sorry, you said there was an affidavit, it was attached to the complaint?
There was a settlement agreement was specifically quoted and and incorporated in the complaint, and then there was an affidavit that was attached to the plaintiff's response to the motion to dismiss.
Okay, but the court didn't consider the affidavit. That was my point.
But even if the court looks just at the settlement agreement that's incorporated into the complaint and quoted from the complaint, the court can reach the conclusion, putting aside whether Mr. Kane knew representations were false, the court can reach the conclusion that there's no fraud claim stated because clearly there's no justifiable reliance. They quote specifically from allegations from paragraphs in the settlement agreement that say the plaintiff did not rely on any representations that Mr. Kane made in the settlement negotiations.
How do you respond to Mr. Schmel's argument about the case law? That it says you can't rely on that essentially boilerplate provision to avoid a claim for fraud.
I think Mr. Schmel misinterprets the case law because that ruling would be tautological. So you can't rely on the agreement that says from the party that says I didn't rely on any representations because you assert fraud by relying on the representations. It becomes tautological, and you could never then have an enforceable that provision, an enforceable settlement agreement.
Isn't the converse of that, though, equally true? A fraud feeser then could put that provision in every contract and you know, lie until the heavens rain down thunderbolts and just say, I'm protected by the contract.
Yeah, but that's that may be true. That's not the case we have here. We have a situation where the plaintiff had was represented by counsel. The counsel specifically built into the settlement agreement, which is incorporated into the complaint, a remedy for this alleged misrepresentation regarding the value of the lots. Remember, the plaintiff alleges that as part of the consideration, the underlying defendant, Smith and Bunnell, agreed to convey three lots they believed to be worth $50,000. If the court looks at paragraph 2C of the settlement agreement, which is specifically quoted in the complaint, it says if the value of the lots don't turn out to be $50,000, the plaintiff can get an appraisal, get the difference between the $50,000 and what the appraisal says, and add that to the promissory note, which is attached to the settlement agreement. So this is a situation where the plaintiff had their protection, built it into the settlement agreement, and then instead of executing on the or enforcing the rights under the settlement agreement, sued Mr. Kane for fraud.
Did you argue that below?
We did argue that below, that the settlement agreement specifically specifically precludes a fraud claim. I'm at 7:55. Let me make a couple of other arguments, and then I'll sit down. The record refutes the record refutes that any of the representations that Mr. Kane allegedly made would have been material, because all of the representations that they allege Mr. Kane made during this two-hour settlement conference in the middle of trial were about the lots, that the lots were ready to build, that the lots were good to go. All of that, though, was discharged or dealt with in the settlement agreement with respect to paragraph 2C that builds in the right for the plaintiff to address the consequences if the belief about the $50,000 value of the lots turns out not to be correct.
You're saying that's an exclusive remedy for fraud?
I'm not saying that's an exclusive remedy for fraud. There could be, if there's other fraud, there
could be an exclusive remedy for fraud relating to the lots.
I'm saying that the parties assumed the risk of a misrepresentation related to the lots, and they built in that risk specifically in the settlement agreement.
Isn't that an argument? And again, I know I got limited time. I'll apologize to your counsel, your co-counsel. If they win fraud in the inducement, the whole contract goes away. Isn't that the point? Their argument is fraud in the inducement of the settlement agreement.
Actually, they have not alleged fraud in the inducement. They've alleged fraud as an affirmative right to relief. I think fraud, you could allege fraud in the inducement, but their claim is fraud by misrepresentations, not to void the contract, but to get damages as a result of what happened. And that's a very different kind of claim. And with that, I'll sit down and give the rest of my time to myself.
Hey, what, counsel? Why don't you go ahead and take a couple extra minutes because of all the questions, and we will give the appellant a couple of extra minutes at the end because he's down to about 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel.
So run 2 minutes over your time.
That sounds great. My name is Charlie Shoup, attorney registration number 40550, and I represent the appellees Rod Smith and Kevin Bunnell. Before I get into my argument, I'd like to key in on a few statements made by Mr. Schmel. Number one, we heard Mr. Schmel concede that the lower court in the first case had jurisdiction to rule on here and the authority to deny the motion to reform. Now that's different. I want to draw a distinction here between the lack of authority to grant the relief that the appellants requested in that motion to reform, which we concede that the trial court lacked. But the fact that they had authority to hear, deny, rule on, and deny that motion to reform means that the factual findings that the trial court found in its order denying the motion to reform stand, because the bottom line is that the appellate court in that first case, Affordable Country Homes, affirmed that decision.
How is that a final judgment on the merits of a fraud claim?
Well, Your Honor, the appellants also concede in their reply brief that the dispute is not whether it constitutes a final judgment on the merits, but whether it's on the merits itself. They concede that it's a final judgment. The fact that this motion was fully litigated, we had, you know, nearly 100 pages of facts were presented before the first trial court. And, you know, the briefing was 15 pages long. The trial court in that first case took a good long look at it. And they said, okay, I can't grant relief requested. Well, this is what the appellate court said, that no, they can't grant, the trial court cannot grant the relief requested. But, I'm going to affirm those factual findings anyways.
But the division said that the trial court had no authority to rule on the Rule 60. The court also said, but we expressed no opinion on whether he could file a separate suit. Now, related to this, have you, wondering whether you saw the division's opinion in a case called Sawyer versus Kindred Nursing Home?
I'm not familiar with that case.
It's a relatively new case, and I happen to know it because I was on the division. I'll tell you what the facts are, and I'd be interested in your response. In Sawyer, it involved a woman dies. It was kind of a nursing home malpractice, I think. Lady dies. There was never a substitution of her kids as the plaintiffs, okay? And the case gets dismissed for failure to substitute under Rule 25. It turns out the kids never got served. They never got noticed that they were supposed to substitute. Therefore, the division said there was no authority to dismiss because there was no service. Therefore, there's no res judicata because you don't have a final judgment. The basic holding is without authority to rule, it's not a final judgment. And again, you'll have to take my word for it. That's pretty close, I think. How is that, assuming everything I just said is right, how is that different from this case?
Well, again, and I'm not familiar with the case, but it does sound very familiar to one that we did cite, and that's JHV People. Again, that's in our answer brief, and that, I believe, held the exact opposite. The fact that a child wasn't named a party stripped the court of its jurisdiction, yet the court still found that public policy, the interest and finality of a judgment, means that we're going to go ahead and apply claim preclusion anyway, even though the trial court didn't have jurisdiction. And one reason is because that they fully litigated it. So they fully litigated the matter to conclusion, but the fact that they didn't have jurisdiction to do that in the first place meant that, you know, they were still going to apply claim preclusion. I also want to key in on a couple statements you said about the appellate court's ruling in Affordable Country Homes. First, you mentioned that they did say we express no opinion, and I encourage you to take that at face value, no opinion as to whether they, you know, the appellants could bring an independent suit or not. Also, I want to stress the fact that that court said we do not have authority to grant the relief requested, not that we don't have the authority to hear it, rule on it, and deny it, which you just heard the appellees concede. Now, had the court felt that the trial court didn't have authority to, again, hear, rule on, or deny relief requested, it could have simply vacated that order, or it could have remanded with instructions to the trial court to dismiss it based on, you know, a want of jurisdiction. It didn't. It affirmed that ruling, and with it, it affirmed the factual findings that the trial court issued. I also want to remind this court again of the public policy behind the rule, which is to prevent the relitigation of matters that have been litigated in the interest of finality and judicial economy. We're standing here today with the appellant's essentially sixth bite of the apple, and one of those bites, which I've talked about in the briefing and the all the factual evidence that was presented in the motion to reform, was a pretty big bite. And so to permit these appellants to keep coming back, especially considering the representations that they made in that settlement agreement as to their investigation of the facts and their and the fact that they didn't rely on anything else and they assumed all the risks, I think certainly counsels in favor of applying claim preclusion here based on public policy.
Can I give you a hypothetical, Mr. Shoup? Take a case where somebody files a claim in federal court, argues there was diversity of citizenship, argues full motion, there's all kinds of motions, the court rules, let's say, for the defendant in the case, goes up on appeal, and the court says there wasn't $75,000, there was no subject matter jurisdiction, goodbye. They refile in state court. It seems that where your argument would take us would be, hey, the district court ruled on the merits, you got your bite at it, res judicata. It seems to me it's a void judgment because the court never had authority to rule in the first place. I don't see how our case is different here. There was, yes, you argued from here to kingdom come about the propriety, whether it was fraudulent or not, but ultimately the district court did not have the authority to rule. So how is that a final judgment? Go ahead.
Let me play with your hypothetical. Are you saying that the people that are refiling actually brought up and raised the issue of
And the district court ruled on it, and the appellate court then said, but there was no subject matter jurisdiction. Judgment is void. And then it gets refiled in state court appropriately. So it seems to me you would argue, hey, they litigated it, and the district court ruled on it. You're done.
So they never got the first court got to the merits of the case.
Yes, that's my hypothetical.
After ruling on diversity, just
district court doesn't address diversity, say, or assumes it has jurisdiction. District court rules on the merits. The circuit court, the 10th circuit, reverses on the grounds that there was no subject matter jurisdiction.
Right, and again, I would stress that it was appellant's decision to bring this action to raise these factual issues related to the alleged fraud in the, in their motion to reform. There's got to be some sort of balance of equities here that they're trying their hand in this form, now they're trying their hand in this form, and, when does it all end?
Let me try a little different approach. Is that
sure?
Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm not.
Okay. Based on the appellate opinion in the prior case, shouldn't the lower court have said to Mr. Hegwood, you have asked for relief beyond that permitted by 60B, and I need say no more?
The lower court could have done that?
Well, not could have, but it should have based on what the appellate court said, correct?
It probably should have done that.
Okay, well, let's assume that the lower court had done that. How would that be a decision on the merits?
Well, it wouldn't be a decision on the merits.
So if the lower court had done what it should have done, there would have been no decision on the merits.
If the lower court would have simply dismissed and said, I can't hear this, then no, of course there wouldn't be a decision on the merits. I don't know that the lower court with the motion that was in front of it couldn't have said, okay, even though it wasn't specifically asked for by the appellants, couldn't have, if the facts were, under the right circumstances, it could have just set aside the judgment of dismissal. I'm not sure that the trial court could not have done that, even though it was not specifically asked for. So I guess I take that back. I think it was appropriate for the trial court to hear that motion, issue factual findings, and And, you know, I think it was also appropriate for the Court of Appeals to simply affirm those factual findings. And that's the bottom line here, is that, you know, there's no dispute that standing alone, that trial court order was a final judgment on the merits. The dispute is whether the appellate court's simple statement that they lack the authority to grant the relief requested strips it of the finality and strips it of the merits, and we submit that it does not. So
I think you've run a couple of minutes over. If you want to wrap up in a sentence, that's fine. Otherwise,
I think we just did, Your Honor.
Okay.
So appreciate it. Thank you.
You've got 30 seconds left, and the clerk's giving you, the bailiff's giving you another 2 minutes. So when the red light's on, you're done.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address, first of all, one issue that's been discussed, and that is the decision was on the merits. The decision was not on the merits. Mr. Hegwood appealed the decision to the Court of Appeals, and some of the issues he raised, for example, were that records buried in the vaults of the Greeley Planning Department are not public, are not constructive notice under Colorado statute. The issues that were raised on appeal were never heard. So Mr. Hegwood has not had a fully litigated action in this matter.
But your position simply is that even if the district court reached all these issues for purposes of finality because the appellate court did not, that ends the finality inquiry.
Yes, and Your Honor, the finality of judgment, we did not consent that there was a final judgment on the merits. We argued expressly in our brief that there was a finality of judgment with respect to the right to appeal, but not with respect to a judgment on the merits. There was no judgment on the merits because the appellate court, under its own power, took those arguments away and ruled strictly on jurisdictional grounds after asking the parties to brief that issue. And notably, both parties briefed the issue and said the appellate court had jurisdiction. And the appellate court reviewed federal cases and state cases, and it, as a matter of first impression, ruled that no, in fact, the lower court didn't have that. And as stated in the pleadings, I researched the issue before I filed the Rule 60 motion to try and determine the right way to approach this. And I found no authority in Colorado. The court ruled it. We brought it up on appeal. It was an issue of first impression.
Mr. Schmidt, would you address your colleague's argument about the certificate of review as it relates to Defendant Kane?
The certificate of review, I wasn't prepared to argue that, Your Honor, but I am aware that there are Colorado Supreme Court cases that say that if it's an obvious malpractice, that you don't need an expert. That's the first point. And secondly, there is no claim of malpractice here. This is straight fraud. Mr. Kane's obligation was exactly the same as if he was a carpenter or anyone else. He had no additional obligations because he was a attorney, and we would submit that he had no lesser duty because he was an attorney with respect to what is required to be disclosed in contracts.
Thank you.
We appreciate the oral arguments of both counsel, and we appreciate your accommodating my adjustment of the time a little bit. Counsel are excused. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Since that concludes our docket, the bailiff may announce a recess.